Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
He's a New York Times best-selling author. He's a TV host, YouTube sensation, TED speaker, classic rocker, and by this stage, an honorary Irishman. Most of the time we get to interview him when he's in Dublin, but as we're in his home state, it's great to say hello to Chris Hadfield. Hello, Chris.
I'm well, Bobby, and it's not states in Canada, it's provinces.
Thank you for that. Welcome
to my home province.
Tell us about that province. Tell us about Sarnia, Ontario, and even Apollo 11 at that time. What did it mean to you?
It's amazing. I've traveled the whole world. I've been around it thousands and thousands of times. I've been to 100 countries, but I'm now back living in the same town where I was born, as you mentioned, Sarnia, Ontario. It's a lovely small town. It was where oil was first discovered in North America.
Is that right?
And so trying to get the product to transport is the reason Sarnia is there. It was water, getting onto the Great Lakes. So Sarnia has a long history as an industrial town, but over 150 years, it's now just a beautiful town where the Great Lakes, perfectly clear blue water, flows by. The Blue Water Bridge is right there. It's on the American border. My dad was working there as a pilot, and when I was 9 or 10 in the summertime is when the very first astronauts walked on the moon, Neil and Buzz, and I just looked around and thought, of all the things that are going on in the world right now, that's the most interesting. That's wow. New. That's exciting. That's right on the cutting edge of what humanity is doing. It's our dreams of tens of thousands of years turning into a reality. I want to be part of that. And so even though I was just some little Canadian kid from Sarnia, I made a decision that hot July night that that's what I wanted to do when I grew up.
What was your route to space?
Well, I recognized early on, Bobby, that there's no way I'm going to get to be an astronaut. And so I tried to choose a life that no matter which floor of my aspirations I had to get off on, it was going to be an interesting life. And I thought pilots, my dad's a pilot, you could lose your medical in a second. You know, sure. You get a piece of metal in your eye or something. So I thought first I'd better be an engineer. And so I studied in university and I became a pilot as a teenager. I wanted to serve Canada. I believe very strongly in this country. So I joined the Air Force and I became a pilot. And part of it was I looked at those first astronauts and thought, how did they get to be astronauts?
Right.
And you're piloting a spaceship and you're testing a spaceship. So probably the best path is to be an engineer, pilot, fighter pilot, test pilot, like they were. And it all sounded interesting. If I was going to be an engineer for the rest of my life or a pilot, those all sounded good. So that's what I did. I joined the Air Force at 18 and became a combat fighter pilot in the Cold War, and then went to test pilot school in America, became a test pilot, and went to university again. And after all of that, got selected by the brand new Canadian Space Agency as an astronaut.
Okay. And that was a big day for you.
As big as it gets, yeah. You know, it's, I don't know what it's like to climb Everest, but you climb, interminably, and then suddenly you hit a rise and you can see to the other side, not just your imagination of what it looks like on the other side, but you're at a watershed. And the day that the Canadian Space Agency phoned me was a real watershed.
Tell us about your first trip into space.
It was only 26 years after I decided to be an astronaut.
Right.
So 26 years of training and self-change and preparation and study. And I was part of a crew going, flying on a space shuttle, Space Shuttle Atlantis, launching out of Florida, going up to help build the Russian space station Mir. You know, just 6 years before, I'd been a fighter pilot intercepting Soviet bombers that were practicing attacks on North America. Here I am 6 years later, and now I'm cooperating, Soviet Union fall apart, flying, cooperating with the Russians, helping to build their space station, and first Canadian to operate the Canadarm, our big robot arm up on the space station. Just a quick mission, 8.5 days, just 26 years to get ready for it, but spectacular human experience to leave Earth with a crew of competent people, do something that's brand new, and then safely return.
Is it sort of like project to project? Like, does there always have to be progression?
It depends how you look at your life. you haven't done just one thing in your life, Bobby.
No.
And you might call some of the steps not necessarily a progression, but it is. It's the progression of your life. And in my case, I still feel very much that I am progressing. You know, all the companies that I help run right now and the tech incubator that I run and the six books that I've written. And for me, all of those are progression.
Yeah.
And so my 21 years serving as an astronaut felt the same way. From the day I walked in as a brand new baby astronaut, learning a huge amount on my first space flight, and then doing spacewalks on my second space flight, and in between flights, having steadily increasing levels of responsibility. I was the chief of space station operations. I was NASA's director of operations in Russia, lived in Russia for 5 years.
Yeah.
And so, always progressing and learning new things. And I feel like I've got this huge toolbox next to me that I've just been adding tools to so that I can crack more and more problems throughout my entire life.
What's your take on the world's relationship with the moon now? Is it similar to the time of like Apollo 8? Like there was loads of social unrest, wars.
Yeah, so there were two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, and the United States was losing, and so they gave themselves a crazy accelerated task to try and put Americans on the moon before the Soviets could. And incredibly, from the time of deciding, 8.5 years, they put someone on the moon, and in the process of getting ready for landing on the moon, as you mentioned, Apollo 8, which was just around the moon and back.
Yeah.
And that's what's just happened with Artemis II. And I think there's this weird perception that there was some long, rapturous period when everybody in the world was fascinated by Apollo. That's not what it was like at all. The whole world watched for, you know, a week while Apollo 8, and they went, oh, wow, that's a really cool picture they brought back. And then for a very brief period during Apollo 11, it caught everybody's attention. But by Apollo 12, everyone was bored with it. You know, when you just view space exploration and confuse it with space entertainment, of course you're going to lose interest. But that's happening right now. Two large superpowers, United States and China. China is ahead. They've already landed on the far side of the moon with probes and brought samples back, and they are inexorably moving to land people on the moon by 2030, and the United States again is like, whoa, we're got to hurry up and try and do it first and get there before the Chinese do. And also, now it's not just proof, but now it's a territory. And this is, I work a lot of different areas, but whoever gets there first has just historically a significant claim, and it's really important how we decide to do this.
What are the biggest challenges to life on the moon?
The biggest is air. You can't go without air for 10 minutes. So you have to bring enough air with you until you can start generating oxygen, at least pure oxygen on the surface. The next thing you die with is water. You know, you can't go too long without water. So then you need to bring enough water with you until you can start generating hydrogen and oxygen and water on the surface. And then after that, you need shelter. And then you need power for it all. And then eventually you'll need food.
Right.
So that whole process, we'll bring everything at first, but as soon as we can, we want to be able to harvest what naturally occurs on the moon. And we think there are vast reserves of water frozen into the permanently shadowed craters. That would help a lot because water is just hydrogen and oxygen.
Yeah.
And the oxygen we can bubble out and breathe. The hydrogen and oxygen we can mix together as fuel and drink it as water. So we're hoping it is what all our sensors have told us. And then eventually, once we've got a habitat and power and water and air, then we'll think about farming and just living there. But we're just in those early stages of that right now.
You have a lot of records, but is it fair to say that you were the first social media astronaut?
Well, I don't know. There are others, but it's been, you know, millions and millions of people know more about the space program. They recognize it as interesting as a result of using technology to share it. But I was so hugely influenced by how the Apollo astronauts shared their experience.
Yeah.
I wasn't that much by the Soviets because they didn't share it. You know, it was all secret. And so I just resolved, hey, if I ever get to do something like that, I'm going to use whatever technology exists to try and share it as best I can.
Chris, can I ask you about your love of music and bringing music to space? Because what you've done, the David Bowie stuff, it's been hugely entertaining, and it's just been a real pleasure to watch.
I've been a musician my whole life, singer, songwriter. I've fronted lots of bands. I tour with bands. I co-write with lots of bands. I've played in pubs. You know, I played in Cobblestone 3 days ago.
Good man.
In Dublin. So just because you leave Earth doesn't mean you're going to stop being a musician. And in fact, there's a guitar permanently up on the space station just for psychological support. And so, of course, while I was up there, I played it, you know, for parties and birthdays and everything.
Brilliant.
But then I thought, while I'm here, I should write music. This is an unusual place. And so I wrote a whole album and recorded, just using GarageBand, recorded an album, and then did a version of Space Oddity with David Bowie's permission that he absolutely loved and hundreds of millions of people have seen. So, but I you know, it's, to me, that's just one more way, almost like a different language of a way to share what you're thinking and what you're feeling and what it's like to live on a spaceship. And so being able to share it musically and take advantage of all that technology, I think was just lucky circumstances that I was there then.
I want to just talk to you briefly about Ireland, but the connection is it true that there's Matt Malloy's flute has made it up to outer space?
One of my longtime friend astronauts, she and I were classmates, hired the same day. We've been in bands together since 92, and she's a good flute player, Katie Coleman. She's also a PhD chemist and a colonel in the Air Force, but great musician, and she's played with the Chieftains many times, as have I, different countries around the world, even from orbit, back and forth cooperatively. And she took Matt Malloy's, one of his old flutes, and then I've gone over to the West Coast and played at his pub. In his pub with Matt. That actually, they phoned Matt and said, hey, Chris Hadfield's here. And so he like got out of his pajamas and put his pants on and came in, and we sat and played. But music is everywhere on Earth, and often a place will influence music. And so I'm really curious how the space station, but eventually settling on the moon, is going to slowly modify and evolve a different style of music in a new place.
Finally, can I ask you about your relationship with Ireland? Ireland loves you, and hopefully it's mutual.
It is. I love Ireland. My daughter's a professor at Trinity, and she did her PhD there as well, and so did her husband. And so they live in Ireland, and my wife and I are in the process of buying property there so that we can spend... We have a granddaughter there now, too. No greater magnet than a granddaughter.
That's it.
And so, as a grandparent, we don't want to miss her growing up, our Irish granddaughter named Wren, W-R-E-N. And
beautiful.
I was just there this week, and we'll be spending a significant part of each year in Dublin, which I'm greatly looking forward to. And I hear the flying weather isn't always perfect there, but I think it'll be okay.
Thanks for joining us, Chris. It's been a real pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure, and enjoy your time here in Ontario.
Thank
in
you
Canada.
So much.
Thank you.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.